Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's Breakthrough Treatment Option teleconference. All parties are currently in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, a question-and-answer session will be conducted at the moderator's discretion. At that time, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 1 on your touch-tone phone. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Outreach and Education for the National MS Society, Greater Northwest Chapter. Piper, you may begin.
Okay, thank you, Alma. And thank you all for joining us, everybody who's on the line this evening. Really pleased to have you be a part of our program. We've got a great informational program in store for you with two wonderful guest speakers who've joined us for the evening, Dr. Pavel Rapovich and Dr. Shana Johnson. We're very pleased to have these two esteemed professionals join us to talk about breakthrough treatment options for people with MS. So let me introduce them to you, and then I'll pass the floor to them, and they'll take it from there. So first we have Dr. Pavel Rapovich. He's an MS specialist at the Swedish Neuroscience Institute in Seattle. He received his neurology training at Cornell New York Presbyterian Hospital, followed by a fellowship in MS and neuroimmunology at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. He has been involved in a number of clinical trials of novel treatments for MS. Dr. Rapovich is a recipient of the Sylvia Lowry Physician Fellowship Grant from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Great to have you with us, Dr. Rapovich. We also have Dr. Shana Johnson. And Dr. Johnson is a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician who specializes in the management and rehabilitation of multiple sclerosis. She received her medical degree from the Medical College of Wisconsin and completed a physical medicine and rehabilitation residency at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She completed a multiple sclerosis fellowship at the University of Washington Medical Center under George Kraft. And she relocated to the Olympia area following the completion of her fellowship and joined the Providence Physical Medicine Group last fall. So thank you as well, Dr. Johnson, for being a part of our program. All right, so I'll pass the floor to Dr. Rapovich, and I hope you all have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and thank you, Piper, for that nice introduction. Thanks to everybody who is joining us as well. I should just mention that during the initial part of our presentation, your lines are muted. Alma may have mentioned that earlier, but as a result, I won't be hearing anything other than myself and Dr. Johnson during the first part of this presentation. But then during the Q&A section, we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. We thought we could start tonight's conference by a brief overview of what it takes for a given treatment to become a reality rather than just a project in a lab or somebody's imagination. And this process is best defined through pipeline of clinical trials. So anytime that any idea surfaces in the lab or in somebody's head, the first part of testing this idea is preclinical. Basically, someone has an idea, they have a medication or an intervention, and usually they will apply this in either animal studies or some other kind of models to see whether it actually can do something for the disease they're studying. So these are the sort of preclinical testing phases. Then come the two stages of the four stages of clinical trials. In stage one, the primary objective is to check the safety of this intervention. So I'll stick with medicines because they're really easier, but this really applies to medicines, interventions, devices, anything basically. So in this first phase, they're testing whether the medicine is safe. They don't test whether it's working, but they just test whether it's safe. And then in phase two, if it's safe enough, in phase two, they will start first investigations of whether it's efficient, whether it's doing what it's supposed to do against the disease, and continuing to monitor the safety. These are small trials of about 20 to 300 patients at most, and this is really where most of the medicines fail. If they succeed and have a desired effect at that phase, phase two, they move to phase three. And phase three trials are the definitive efficiency efficacy trials. These involve anywhere between 300 and 3,000 or even more patients. They are randomized, controlled, and multicenter, which means they usually have a no treatment and an exploratory treatment side by side. And they're usually conducted across multiple medical centers. And once the phase three trials are successfully completed, the medication is submitted for the approval of the FDA or other regulatory agency. After the approval, the trial, there is still one phase of trial, which is phase four, which is the post-marketing surveillance. Some medications, especially those that have certain hazardous side effects, need to be monitored even after they come to the market to see really how safe they are. You should realize that through this entire process, no more than 5,000 to 10,000 people receive this medicine. And consequently, some rare side effects don't even become apparent until the medicine is out on the shelves. This is why phase four is very important. You should also be aware that about 1,000 potential medicines are tested for everyone that actually enters a clinical trial. So this process of whittling down the candidates is fairly rigorous. And it takes time from starting the trials to the time it's marketed. An average medicine may take about 8 years. There have been initiatives to shorten this time and make certain drugs a priority for diseases that have no treatment. And then if the medicine comes along that's particularly revolutionary or promises to be revolutionary, FDA will grant it a so-called fast-track review, where instead of the usual 10 months, it takes about 6 months to review the application and decide whether the medicine can or cannot be marketed. Now, moving from the general discussion of trials to MS specifically, it is evident that MS trials present unique challenges because of several things. MS is a diverse disease. As many of you know, there are different types of MS. There is relapsing remitting, probably the most common kind, secondary progressive, primary progressive, and even the so-called pre-MS or clinically isolated syndrome. To study them as a single disease is really not fair to the patients or to the medicine, because something that may work in one kind of MS may not really work in another. So the solution to this problem is to limit the trials to a particular group of patients. Another reason why MS trials are challenging is that, as you all know, MS is unpredictable. The relapses can occur any time. They can occur often or rarely. And similarly, the progressive disease can progress slower or faster. Consequently, the solution to this problem has been to define clear inclusion criteria to standardize the population that is under the study so that only the very active patients are being recruited into the trial, or only slow progressive patients are included. Another reason why MS is challenging to study is that MS has a very strong subjective component that may or may not correlate with objective findings. We all want our patients to do well. As clinicians, if we know somebody is on a medicine that offers a chance of treatment, we really want them to succeed. We want the medicine to work, and we want our patients to do better. But, you know, that is just us being subjective. So the solution to this is that a good trial is the one that is blinded, which means that neither I as a clinician nor patients as a study subject know what they're receiving, whether they're receiving the medication in trial or perhaps a placebo, a sugar pill, or maybe just a regular treatment. So blinding is very important, as is randomization, which means three patients in a row in a study don't receive the same treatment. They may get any option. And then the other way to get around the subjective component of MS in trials is to use hard outcomes, such as MRI, which you and I, nobody can wish an MRI plaque to go away. It's fairly convincing if it shows up. Lastly, MS disability is really what we're all trying to target. If I could cure every relapse, and, you know, then I would really only care about relapses, but we know that disability can occur outside of relapses, especially in progressive disease. And this disability, which is sort of a hope that we can reverse or stop, at least, takes time to accumulate. And for that reason, to really study disability, you really need to have a fairly long trial. So there have been solutions to that, where we use something called sustained disability, where we measure things a little bit apart and then make sure that that correlates with long-term outcomes. And then we also try to use surrogate markers like MRI. But these are the challenges that MS trials face, and all MS medications face as they stand to enter the clinical pipeline. So I've given you this overview of various trials, phases, and measurements, not so I could lecture you about it, but because the rest of our talk will talk about treatments that are coming down the pipeline, and it will help you to know how far down that pipeline they are if you know what these phases are. And at this point, I would like to turn the mic and the podium, or whatever you will call it, to my colleague, Dr. Johnson, who will tell us about the most recent and most exciting development in the field of MS.
Thank you, Dr. Kovach. That was wonderful. So in the last week, we've had a very exciting development in the treatment of MS with the FDA approval of the first oral medication called fingolimod, which will be marketed as Gilenya. I'd like to talk a little bit about how we think Gilenya works and talk a little bit about the results of the recent phase 3 trial, which ultimately led to the approval. Some of the safety concerns, just the overall overview of this new medication. So fingolimod is a new mechanism. It works in a way that none of our other MS therapies do. As you know, we treat MS as an autoimmune disease by lowering the immune system's attack on the brain and the spinal cord. Fingolimod works by finding a docking site on immune cells, T cells and B cells, which then inhibits those cells from leaving the lymph nodes and attacking the brain and the spinal cord. Its reduction in circulating lymphocytes or immune cells is about 70%. The most recent trial that's been completed is titled Freedom, and it was a large phase 3 trial. Like Dr. Rapovich had mentioned, they tested fingolimod blindedly against a placebo over a 2-year period. they tested it at two doses, at a 0.5 milligram dose and at a higher dose. With this, they found that fingolimod reduced relapse rates by 64% compared to placebo. There was also an earlier phase 3 trial, which they titled Transform, where fingolimod was directly compared to Avonex. In this study, fingolimod reduced relapse rates by 52% compared to Avonex. In Freedom, they also found that disability progression was reduced by 30%, and there was a reduced rate of loss of brain volume, which we sometimes use the term atrophy to describe. In this trial, they tested two doses of fingolimod, a lower dose and a higher dose. At the end of the study, it was determined that the lower dose was just as efficacious, but likely safer, and that's the dose that we'll be moving forward. Now, in regards to safety data with fingolimod, the most common adverse reactions listed were headache, flu, diarrhea, back pain, liver enzyme elevations, and cough. More serious adverse reactions were a decrease in heart rate with the first dose of fingolimod. The medical term for that is bradycardia. A increased risk of infection, in particular, lower respiratory infection. In the Transform phase 3 trial, there were two fatal herpes infections. Risk of macular edema, which is swelling of the center of the retina. A small increase in blood pressure. So if your blood pressure normally was like 130 over 80, your blood pressure might go up to 133 over 80. Increase in liver enzymes. And of course, it can't be taken if there's any possibility of pregnancy. So overall, the safety profile is actually quite good. However, the long-term safety is unknown. As Dr. Rupovich mentioned, it is now going to be entering the surveillance phase where we may see other adverse reactions that have not yet been seen that are more rare. Because of the above noted adverse reactions seen in the phase 3 studies, there is going to be a fair amount of monitoring that, if your physician deems this is appropriate for you, that will be done, including checking your blood counts, eye exams, possibly an EKG, and a varicella vaccine. Fingolimod will likely be available in the next couple of weeks. And it comes in a oral form that is taken once a day with or without food. And this, you know, this represents the first oral therapy for MS, so it's a very exciting time. And I think I'll stop there for now because I'm sure at the end of this you all are going to have a lot of questions in regards to fingolimod. So at this point, I believe Dr. Rupovich would like to talk a little bit more about other drugs that are later in the pipeline.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. I don't know if any of you have been keeping a notepad by your side, jotting down some of the numbers that Dr. Johnson mentioned. But before I move on to the medicine that I will talk about, I do want to just bring one thing to your attention. And that is that in Freedom's trial, the one against the placebo, the reduction in rate was 54%. In Transform's trial against Avonex, the reduction was 52%. Don't make the mistake of comparing these two trials one to another. This is a sort of a beginner's mistake that I learned the hard way when I started my medical training. But I do want to mention it to you because that each trial, you can think of it as almost a universe to itself because of variables and all kinds of other things that we really cannot control. So one number in one trial and another number in another trial are, you know, if they're the same number, that doesn't mean the medicines are the same, because we do know that Avonex is certainly more effective than placebo. Now, just with that one little note, I'm going to move on to cladribine, which is another oral medication that I will tell you a little bit about where that stands in its pipeline. So cladribine is a pill. It is basically a pill form of a chemo that's been around for at least 10 years. Cladribine was discovered at Scripps Research Institute in California in 1983. The way that it works is that it's very similar to one of the building blocks of the DNA, of the genetic material that makes up our cells. And when cladribine gets into the cells, it gets a little bit modified and then gets placed into the DNA. What that creates is a damage to that DNA, which then needs to be repaired. And as the cell tries to repair the damage, it effectively commits a suicide because it runs out of a very important element that it needs for other functions to survive, to live. Of course, such a toxic therapy would be very dangerous if it was unselected. But what happens is that cladribine preferentially is taken up and activated in these immune cells, the lymphocytes that Dr. Johnson mentioned, and the same cells that are trapped in the lymph nodes by fingolimod. So what cladribine does is it doesn't trap them, but it kills them. And in doing so, the theory was that maybe by eliminating these cells or by knocking down their numbers, the MS disease, relapsing forms of MS, could be treated. Cladribine has moved through several phases, and the most recent phase is the phase 3 trial called Clarity that was completed and in fact reported at the very same time as the fingolimod trial earlier this year. The Clarity trial involved around 1,300 patients. It compared these patients, divided into three groups. One group got placebo, one group got 3.5 milligrams of cladribine, and the other got 5.25 milligrams. I should take a moment here to tell you how cladribine was given, because it is a very, very convenient medicine. It was taken as a pill once a day for 4 to 5 days. So you take it for 5 days, you repeat that on only the first week of 4 months. And then it works and stays active for the rest of the year. This is a very long acting medication. And then next year, instead of doing it for 4 months, for 1 week, for 4 months, you do it for 1 week for 2 months. And then it still stays active for the whole rest of the second year. So what they found is that when patients were treated with this medication, they had a reduction in the relapse rate by about 50-60%. There was not much difference between the lower dose and the higher dose in terms of efficacy. But there was difference in terms of side effects. The other things they looked at were typical MRI things, which I don't need to bore you about, but it was very effective there, minimizing the evidence of disease on MRI by as much as 70 to 88%. And it also slowed down the disability progression. If you'll recall, I mentioned this disability as the sort of holy grail of MS treatment, and this medicine was able to show some effect on that disability, at least in the short term. But it was not a benign medicine. As would be predicted by its own mode of action, it knocked down the number of defensive cells, the lymphocytes, significantly. And in doing so, it exposed patients to a certain degree to infections. Most of these infections were not serious. There were no deaths from herpes or, from herpes like in pneumothorax. However, there were plenty of infections. There were about 20 patients who had a shingles outbreak and in quadrivalent group. So that was an important consideration. 6 people died, but they died from things that probably some of them didn't maybe even have anything to do with the medicine. One person drowned, one had a heart attack, one had a stroke, one committed a suicide. I think we'll all agree that these were probably not related to the medicine. However, there was one case of a pancreatic cancer, and there was one case of tuberculosis that reactivated, and a person died from that reactivated tuberculosis. So going forward, I imagine it will be important to rule out this quiet, latent tuberculosis in anybody who's considering cladribine. The other concern with cladribine is, and I have to qualify this is not well known, but question is, does it increase the risk of cancer? There were 5 benign cancers in patients who were treated with cladribine, but there were also 5 not benign ones, malignant. There was an ovarian cancer, a melanoma, a choriocarcinoma, and a couple of others. So it really does leave that question unanswered at this point. So where is cladribine in terms of its arrival on the market, or where will it ever arrive to the market? Cladribine was actually submitted to the FDA around the same time as fingolimod, but for some reason, and we're not really sure why, FDA sent the application back. The application must have been amended, nobody really knows why, and resubmitted in June, at which point FDA granted it the so-called fast track, which means that we're expected to hear something from the FDA by December of this year about when cladribine may come to the market. I will mention that there are ongoing studies of cladribine. Everybody in the Clarity trial is continuing on the extension of that study. There are other studies looking at a very early MS or a combination of cladribine with interferon beta. But I should also mention it to you that cladribine can actually claim to be the first pill for MS because in Russia it was approved in June of this year for treatment of MS. And in Australia, it was approved just about 3 weeks ago. So we'll see exactly when this medicine makes it, becomes available to our patients here. But it, like Olimod, it will take some deciding as to whether the risks that it carries with it, some of which are unknown, are worth the potential benefit. So without taking any more time on cladribine, I will turn again to... Oh, actually, no. I get to talk about teriflunomide and leuquinimod next myself. I will then take you to a next medication called teriflunomide. Now, this one is a little earlier in the testing stages than cladribine. So teriflunomide is a tablet also. It's taken once a day. And it works by basically disabling cells from proliferating. So it doesn't kill them, but it doesn't let them reproduce, specifically, again, targeting the immune cells. And teriflunomide is closely related to a medicine called leflunomide or Arava, which is actually already out on the market for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. And leflunomide, Arava, has had very good side effect profile. In other words, it's a pretty safe drug. The teriflunomide has been tested only in a phase 2 trial in 179 patients where, you know, because these trials are fairly short, this particular one was 9 months long in duration, they couldn't really measure the relapse rate. They only could measure the MRI activity. And in MRI activity, it showed about 40 to 60% efficacy on the two doses that were tested against the placebo. We'll see what happens in a larger phase 3 trial, which is called Power and Tenzo, that are currently recruiting in our center, among others, actually. And we'll see in probably a year, we'll take for that trial to finish, and then we'll see exactly what that shows. But we are certainly hoping that there will be some good data coming out of there, because it seems to be a safe medicine. Its really most prominent side effect was that the liver enzymes were abnormal, but not extensively abnormal, between 3 and 9 months from starting this medicine. This has not been published, but it has been presented at one of the MS meetings, that in comparison to interferon beta, teriflunomide was 80% more effective over 6 months in minimizing MRI activity. So, again, this was a phase 2 trial, only 116 patients, but, as I said, early results are fairly promising. One more medicine I will tell you about before turning over the mic to Dr. Johnson is leuquinimod. It is also a tablet. It's also taken once a day. We don't actually know how it works, other than that it shifts the immune system away from attacking the brain. And leuquinimod is a cousin of another medicine called lenalidomide, which in fact was very promising in late 1990s. But it had very bad side effects. It was damaging to a heart, and 2 patients died out of 700 who were enrolled in that trial, at which point the decision was made that this is too dangerous a medication and that it should not be tested any further. So that was lenalidomide. Now this is leuquinimod, a cousin of it, if you will, that is being tested now, much more safe, much safer, and it was tested in 2 phase 2 studies. Its data is promising, but not as impressive as that of teriflunomide. Simply looking at some of the numbers, they have tested 3 different doses so far in 2 different trials, and it seems only the highest dose was giving moderate effect. But this moderate effect, of course, could mean a lot because it really seems to be a very safe medication, again, only causing some liver enzyme abnormalities and such, but nothing serious in a total of 500 patients that have received it. There are ongoing phase 3 trials, and it might take us 2 to 3 years to find out what they show. All right. So now I will have Dr. Johnson tell you a little bit about Ampira.
Yeah, well, I guess to have all the fun tonight, because I get to talk about the 2 drugs that have been FDA approved this year.
That's right.
The second one I'm going to talk about is Ampira, or sustained release oral famotidine. Famotidine is the first drug that's really for improving function in MS, and as a rehabilitation specialist, that's kind of my main goal, is what can I do to get someone walking better or improve their balance. So this is a particularly exciting drug for me. Famotidine, in its short-acting form, has been available in a compounded way for many years. It's now available in a sustained-release form, which we think makes it safer. Now, what it is exactly is it's a potassium channel blocker. And what that means is when you think about the nerves in the central nervous system, you have the axon, and then you have the myelin sheath that is over the nerve that helps impulses conduct down it quickly. In MS, you get little areas where this myelin is disrupted. We call that demyelination. We think that the way famotidine may improve function in MS, and in particular walking ability, is that by blocking the potassium channel, it improves conduction through those demyelinated pathways. Previous studies have also shown that it may also help improve visual function, strength, and fatigue, although that will need further study. So I want to just touch upon a little bit the large randomized controlled trial that was published in a very reputable medical journal called The Lancet in 2009. It studied 301 patients with any type of MS, relapsing or progressive, and it studied patients' walking ability on famotidine or on a placebo pill. And the main thing that they were measuring was for a consistent improvement in walking speed. They do that with a test called the Timed 25-Foot Walk Test, where they see how long it takes you to walk 25 feet. And what they found was that 35% of the patients that took the famotidine had a consistent improvement in their walking speed, compared to only 8% of the placebo. In general, this resulted in a 25% improvement in their gait speed. And in this case, we kind of use gait speed as a marker for gait function because, as Dr. Rapovich mentioned earlier, when we do these studies, it's always easier if you have hard objective data. And so walking speed is something that we can measure reproducibly and show an effect versus a survey asking whether you think you're walking better or not, although they felt on survey that they were walking much better as well. They also found that the famotidine group showed improved leg strength compared to the placebo group. Now, in regards to the safety profile of famotidine, it's considered a pretty safe medication. The two main contraindications that prohibit its use are seizure disorder and moderate kidney disease. When you read the product label, it also lists a plethora of other symptoms such as insomnia, fatigue, back pain, and balance disorder. But what I tell my patients is the biggest problem typically is if you've ever had a seizure, it's not usually considered a good idea to take famotidine. Also, currently, famotidine is FDA approved to help improve walking ability. So right now, if you're not walking, the medication tends not to get approved. Okay, so that's famotidine. And the other thing I'd like to clarify is the difference between disease-modifying therapy and symptom management. So the first group of medications that we were talking about, fingolimod, cladribine, teriflunomide, are all disease-modifying agents. In other words, we're hoping that they modify the course of the disease and slow or reduce disability over time. Ampyra, or famotidine, is more of a symptom control medication. It is to help you function better with the walking impairment that you may have, but it does not alter the natural course of the disease, and it does not replace the disease-modifying therapies. And that's a very important point to keep in mind, that just because you're walking better with Ampyra doesn't mean that you should stop your regular disease-modifying therapy. It's an adjunct, if you will, kind of like when you take Provigil to help with fatigue. Okay, so the next topic I'm going to touch on is a little controversial, and that is the role of medical cannabis. So first, let's just talk a little bit about the cannabis plant. There are several plant phenotypes. They contain over 400 chemicals, and about 70 of those chemicals are classified as cannabinoids. One cannabinoid, Delta-9 THC, is the most abundant cannabinoid in the plant. And it is thought to produce the majority of the psychoactive effects of cannabis. It's actually available as an oral pill called Marinol. However, you may notice that we don't prescribe a lot of Marinol. And that's because, as I mentioned earlier, there's 60 or 70 cannabinoids in the marijuana plant. And we're not exactly sure which ones are causing the therapeutic benefit, but we don't actually think it's the THC. Cannabidiol is the second most prevalent cannabinoid in the plant, and it may be responsible for a lot of the therapeutic effects. Now, one question that I had always wondered about was, so why does this work? What is happening in the brain? And what we found, and I'm lucky enough that one of the biggest publishers on medicinal cannabis is in my office, so I have free access to all the papers he's written. But he's written quite a bit about the pathophysiology of medical cannabis. And I'm just going to summarize that briefly. So there's actually two major cannabinoid receptors in the central nervous system, or there's one in the central nervous system, and then there's one that affects immune system cells as well. So we're going to focus more on the type that's in the brain. And these receptors are similar to other receptors for neurotransmitters in the brain, like serotonin or norepinephrine that we hear about. And the cannabinoids bind these receptors and produce their effects. The type of effects that you see are, of course, the euphoria, the psychoactive effects, appetite stimulation, anti-nausea effects, and anti-pain effects, if you will. Now, when it comes to pain effects with cannabinoids, it is of note that they're particularly efficacious for people with neuropathic type pain, which is the burning, tingling, stabbing, sharp shooting pain that is frequently seen in MS and other nervous system disorders. And cannabis is actually fairly well studied. There's actually been meta-analysis done, which is a medical term for analysis of a group of randomized controlled trials that indicate that it is moderately efficacious for the treatment of chronic pain. So, and this is important because there is evidence behind the use of medicinal cannabis for the treatment of neuropathic pain as well as muscle spasms. So then the next question comes that, you know, smoking cannabis is not good for you. It's still toxic to the lungs. So at least at our center, we really do suggest that people either get an herbal vaporizer or ingestion, although titration and dosing when you're ingesting it is much more difficult. So that could be a whole other talk. And lastly, just talk a little bit, so we talked about how cannabis binds receptors in the brain to reduce pain. The mechanism regarding the reduction of spasticity is that cannabis also has an inhibitory effect. And the brain and spinal cord that produces inhibition of the motor neuron. That reduces tone, that reduces spasticity, which reduces the muscle spasms and the pain associated with the muscle spasms. Hopefully, as this is studied more and we develop a more sophisticated knowledge, we can figure out a better way to dose this to optimize the therapeutic cannabinoids and really minimize the psychoactive component, because it is a good medication if we could just minimize the psychoactive effects. Okay. At this point, I'm going to transition to the last topic that I'm going to just touch on briefly so that we can get to the question and answer component, and that is the role of stem cell transplantation in MS. When I was at the University of Washington Medical Center, I did participate in the HALT-MS trial that looked at stem cell transplantation for what they call poor prognosis MS. And I guess the most important thing to maybe note about stem cell transplantation is that it's appropriate for a very specific patient population, and that it does have very serious risks. So stem cell transplantation is typically considered for people with very active, what we call inflammatory MS. An example of that would be someone that, when they get their routine brain MRI, they have four enhancing lesions on it. And, you know, they're having three or four severe relapses per year. And this is continuing despite being on second-line MS therapy, such as Novantrone or Tysabri. So this is indicated for a very severe relapsing course. And for those people, the significant risks can outweigh the benefits. Similar to many of our other MS treatments, the stem cell protocol is not found to be helpful for patients with progressive MS. When I say progressive, I mean when you're not having relapses anymore, but there's just a slow decline in function, a progressive loss of ability to walk or upper extremity function or even cognition. And we don't have a lot of data on stem cells, but thus far it seems to be very efficacious for the appropriate patient, but it does carry a mortality rate or a death rate with it. There's significant risks for infections, malignancies, and we don't have long-term safety data. But for the appropriate patient with severe relapsing inflammatory MS, it can be a good option. But it is not appropriate for progressive MS. All right, Dr. Rapovich, I think that concludes my summary of Empira, cannabis, and stem cell. Is there anything else you would like to talk about before we go to question and answer?
Well, we have maybe 5 more minutes, which is, I think, more than enough to tell you a little bit about vitamin D.
Oh,
which,
good idea.
Which has been a lot in the news as of late. So the story between vitamin D and MS goes a while back, in fact. It was noted back even in the 60s, or in fact even as early as the 50s, that there is an unusual geographic prevalence of MS, in that it is almost unheard of to see MS at around the equator, and that as further you move away from it, either north or south, that the incidence of MS increases. When they looked at it more closely, wasn't, of course, so simple. But the general idea, the general trend, has been well documented in studies of, for example, military recruits who came all over, from all over the United States, and those from the North had more MS cases than those from the South. A few years ago, a group of researchers, in fact a graduate student from Tasmania, which is a little island south of Australia, did a very good study where they looked at vitamin D and found that among that population that they studied, the low vitamin D correlated with a higher risk of developing MS. So patients, this was not testing patients who have MS, this was patients who didn't have MS, and those who were low had a higher risk of developing it down the road. This has subsequently been confirmed in a number of other locations in the Netherlands and in a few other places in Canada, I believe also. And then, of course, the million-dollar question came up, which is, okay, so what do they do for people who already had MS to watch their vitamin D level? And the short answer is we don't know. But it's not, of course, the end of the story. We are looking at that answer. We're looking at that question and trying to answer it with a good study, a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study of vitamin D supplements. And in order to do that, we first had to make sure that vitamin D is safe. So recently, a study was published out of, I believe, Toronto, where patients were given increasing doses of vitamin D up to, I think, 25,000 international units to see whether it's safe. If you will, this would be an equivalent of maybe phase one trial. Is it safe? And fortunately, it was pretty safe. So they are moving on to the next stage to see whether actually supplementing patients will minimize the number of their relapses. But because it's safe, I and a number of other specialists have been a little more proactive in making, in raising the awareness of vitamin D among our patients. So it's very common that I will check somebody's vitamin D when I first see them, and if it is low, I will recommend that they supplement. I think it's a good idea to take vitamin D, the dose that I feel comfortable with and that I know is safe and probably effective in raising the levels, is 2,000 international units a day. But I advise everyone against taking it blindly. Why? Because if you go through the trouble of supplementing, the least you can do is make sure that you supplement enough. So that's why I always check before we start, and then maybe 3 or 6 months down the road to make sure that we've hit the target. And why do I do this? Because in additional studies in the meantime, there has been a relationship between low vitamin D and the risk of relapses 6 months, within the following 6 months. Now we have two studies, one in the pediatric population, those are children with MS, and, well, children, people younger than 18, I should say, with MS, and also in adults, where low vitamin D at a given point in time correlated with a risk of relapse down the road. Now, bear in mind, this does not mean that giving those people vitamin D will prevent that relapse. But if you want to think about it, some of these patients were actually already taking vitamin D. One way to get plenty of vitamin D is obviously to go out in the sun. So there, anybody's vitamin D fluctuates for the year. So these were same patients followed over time, over several years, and those who had, when they had low vitamin D, they had high risk of attack. When they had high vitamin D, they had less risk of attack. So it's fairly suggestive that supplementing is a good idea. So while we are waiting for the formal verification of it, as I said, I and my colleagues have taken a somewhat proactive approach. All right, so I believe that would be it for vitamin D. Like the other symptomatic treatments, I do not think that vitamin D is a substitute for disease-modifying therapy, and so that disclaimer goes as well. And speaking of disclaimers or notes, footnotes, we've been asked by the organizers of this teleconference, the National MS Society, to read the following statement to you. So I will read it, and then right afterwards, we'll open the lines for questions. The National MS Society provides the most up-to-date and comprehensive information and education for people living with MS, family and friends, and healthcare professionals. Finding answers and making decisions relies on having the right information at the right time. MS navigators are available to assist you with MS concerns, large and small. These skilled professionals will listen, discuss, and connect you with the resources to take you to the next step. Whether you are a person living with multiple sclerosis, a friend or caregiver, the National MS Society is a partner in helping you find information and resources you need. Connect to an MS navigator by calling 1-800-344-4867. That's 1-800-344-4867 and press option 1. Okay? Thank you. Hello?
Yes, Mr. Rupo?
We're going to
take questions now, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if there is any questions or comments, please press the number one key on your phone. Our first question comes from Marcella. Go ahead, Marcella.
Hi, I was just calling to let you know that I've been taking Ampura for, I guess that's how you pronounce it, for about a month now, and it's kind of like an upper for me. I don't know if it's just the thought of knowing that it's supposed to make me a lot better and everything, but it feels like an upper, and it really feels good. And that's about it.
Yeah, well, you know, you bring up a really good point, and that is that the FDA has approved Ampura for improving walking speed. But if you think about how MS works and all the areas in the brain and spinal cord that have demyelination, it makes sense from a physiology standpoint that if it's going to help the nerves that help the legs walk, that it could also help the upper extremities or cognition or other circuits that have some demyelination. So I think as we get more experience with it, I'm at least really trying to listen to my patients about other things that they're noticing with it that it may not be FDA approved for, per se. So I think that's a very important comment, and I don't think that's a unique experience either.
Well, that's good.
I would agree. I think that the patients who respond to this medication will readily say so, but there are others who do not. So we oftentimes will always ask you whether you think that it's working. We also, when we get an enthusiastic response like yours, we always make sure we mention it, that you shouldn't take more than two a day. And because it does, you know, taking more than prescribed, crushing or in any other way tampering with the pill really does set you up for that nasty side effect of a seizure. So stick with two, and I hope it continues working for a while, forever.
Thank you very much. I will continue taking it.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Patricia. Go ahead, Patricia.
Hi, I have a comment and a question. The comment is, again, with the Ampura, I've noticed that it's improved my general feeling of well-being. And the question, though, I have is more pointed towards the current oral medication that just got approved. What form of MS is going to be the most appropriate for that type of medication?
Oh, thank you. Fingolimod has been approved for relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. And there is currently a study that's enrolling to evaluate how it works in more progressive disease, but we won't have those results for a few years. So at this time, it is approved like the other current FDA-approved MS medications for relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, and for some patients with secondary progressive MS, we will likely try it in them as well.
Thank you.
Sure.
I would like to just add one more detail. The study that Dr. Johnson mentioned, the study of fingolimod or Gilenya in progressive patients, is indeed ongoing, and we have a few patients who are on that study. I will point out that as it's designed, you might recall my earlier point of pre-selecting a particular population to study. This study is only enrolling patients with primary progressive MS, not secondary progressive. We are hoping in the near future to get started with another therapeutic option for secondary progressive MS, but as you may know, progressive MS is at present very difficult to treat because we have very limited options available to us, and it's our goal to change that, to improve it.
Thank you.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments, please press the number 1 key on your phone. There are no further questions.
No.
Okay.
Are there any questions beyond what the particular topics that we have covered?
Our next question comes from Linda. Go ahead, Linda.
I wanted to ask a question about the vitamin D. I've been thinking about it. It took me a little while to put my question in form, but I take 10,000 every day, and that's at my doctor's recommendation because I have been historically vitamin D deficient. And I'm just wondering, I'm taking one that's available through a naturopath, so getting it from someone valid. But I'm just wondering, if you take too much, what's the danger?
Great question. So a Mayo Clinic study looked at supplementing vitamin D together with calcium, and some of their patients, and I just can't remember exactly how many, not many, but there were some patients who developed kidney stones because vitamin D will help with absorption of calcium, and as you may know, vitamin D is often given to promote bone health. So it might overshoot that target. 10,000 is, I've heard of patients taking 10,000. It's just not what I say, but it's also not something that I discourage actively because, as I said, we're all sort of shooting in the dark here. And while I'm sort of hoping to hit a particular level, I cannot tell you that, taking 2 or 3 times more is necessarily wrong. But I will say this, at a recent meeting in San Antonio of the various MS centers, there was a fascinating poster from a pharmacologist who looked at, I can't remember exactly how many, maybe 10 different formulations of vitamin D. There were no names, there were no brands, there was nothing. It was just sample 1, 2, 3, 4, 10. And the dose, the actual amount of vitamin D in any one of those pills was wildly different. So it is a little disconcerting to even think that these 10,000 units may or may not be indeed 10,000 units. But such is the state of vitamin market that we really don't know. So it's just something that truly took me by surprise.
So that is disappointing.
Yes, because, we all want, when you take that amount, you really take expecting to receive it, right? Mm-hmm. And one should, there should be a better way of regulating this.
Yes.
Our next question comes from Carol. Go ahead, Carol.
Yes. Hi, doctors. My name is Carol, and I've had MS for about 25 years, and I've gone from relapsing, remitting into secondary progressive in the last few years. And I've certainly been on interferons for most of my MS path until in the last recent years. And that's because the interferons really haven't shown in my MRIs to be beneficial. So my question is, is there going to be more aggressive investigation of off-label medication for attacking secondary and primary progressive, in that there aren't really medications approved or in the pipeline that speak to this form of MS?
You are absolutely right. And this is probably one of the greatest areas of need in NS at this point. Because progressive disease, whether primary or secondary, does not have a recognized treatment at this point. Having said that, there are efforts, of course, to mitigate that. One is that fingolimod Gilenya will be tried in primary progressive patients, and that trial is ongoing. Another trial that I know of is a medication that works on mast cells. This is something that we are fairly new to, and because mast cells usually are associated with allergies, but this particular compound has shown some promise in a phase 2 trial, and we are hoping to have that trial open within a few months. And this would be open to both primary and secondary progressive patients. There are other things coming down. They're just not coming down the pipeline fast enough. One that raised a lot of hope was a compound called Lirukotide, DMT something, or maybe DMB. Unfortunately, this was a compound from Canada that initially seemed very promising, but has not worked. The trials of treatments that work for relapsing forms have not given great success or really any objective success in progressive disease, but you know, for certain kinds of patients, they may be tried. Specifically, these would be patients who, even though they might be in a progressive phase of the disease, continue to experience relapses. There may be some benefit to using perhaps not an interferon in your case, but perhaps something else. It is a very individual-wise recommendation that very much depends on the characteristics of each person's disease.
What would you, separate from this, Dr. Zamboni from Italy, who is pursuing the restricting of the veins as a possible possible cause of MS, how is that being perceived in the U.S.? I know in Canada there's a lot more attention to Dr. Zamboni than in the U.S. from what I can see.
Well,
and I was curious your thoughts.
Sure. The phenomenon that you mentioned, the so-called CCSVI,
right,
chronic cerebrospinal venous insufficiency, was described by Dr. Zamboni in his paper in early 2009. This really took the MS community by as a storm. It really was quite a report, because what he found is that every patient with MS who he studied had these clogged veins, and every other patient who didn't have MS didn't. And this was met with certain dose of skepticism, I guess is the mild way to put it, because it just didn't fit with any of this immune theory, which has yielded fairly good therapies, well, decent therapies, I'll say, and continues to yield these kinds of immune-targeting therapies. But be that as it may, the interest was high. In Canada, you are correct, the interest was generated earlier, but I'm not so sure that it's that far behind in the States. And as a result of that, there's been essentially a huge push to see what is very much, you know, whether this can work. A trial of a number of patients done in upstate New York looked at the similar phenomenon, and what they found is that about two-thirds of patients with MS have this, but a third doesn't, and that about 40% of normal patients have this, and the others don't. So suddenly the numbers weren't exactly 0 and 100%. But, you know, there was still greater prevalence in the MS community, in the MS population. Recently, as in last month, two papers came out from Sweden and Germany where they didn't find it at all in MS patients. So these were all smaller studies, not a lot of patients, so you could see how, depending on how things were done, there could have been all kinds of biases. And as a result, the National MS Society, as well as the MS Society of Canada, have joined and generated a fund of, let's say, almost $2 million to study this, you know, on a larger scale. They selected 7 institutions to study the CCSVI. The closest one to us in the Northwest is the one in Vancouver. And I think the first step is just making sure, confirming that this is indeed present in MS patients. The next step will be checking whether intervening, whether opening these blockages has any effect on MS. There are various information, some anecdotal, some not, that this might work. What is less often publicized are the risks of these procedures. There, so far, we know of at least one death from a patient who underwent this procedure to open up blockages and to have a stent, sort of like an expander, placed in the vein. She was anticoagulated, meaning her blood was thinned because of the procedure, and she died from bleeding because of this. A second case with a complication that we know of was a patient who had a stent placed, but whose stent dislodged and went into their heart. So they had to have an open heart surgery to get this back, to take it out. So at that point, you know, I think many people said, well, we're not going to put this down, but we will just do the dilation. And I think that there are still a number of places, some within the States and some abroad, that do this. My advice to my patients has been that this is a finding that it still needs a good sort of verification, basically, and that if they wish to pursue it in terms of testing or intervention, that it really should be done within the context of an actual legitimate trial. There are now 7, as I mentioned, so we're hoping to have some of those answers soon.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Our next question comes from Linda. Go ahead.
Doctor, I have a question about MS and seasonal affective depression. I know there is some correlation for people like me who have MS who suffer from depression. And for me, it does seem to be cyclical, and I'm just wondering, particularly in the gray of wet northwest. Do those light boxes help?
I don't have any studies to back up what I'm saying, but I have heard that they can be helpful. Dr. Popovich, do you have any more detailed information on that?
I think they're helpful for the seasonal affective disorder. That is fairly well established. Whether they're helpful for MS, I don't know if anyone's looked. Having said that, I am relatively new to the Northwest. I trained in New York, and so I'm looking at my first Northwest fall and winter, and I've been warned about what to expect. So I think I will definitely be getting one of those sun lamps. People have told me you must get one. So I should be heading there soon.
Well, I moved here from Rhode Island, and so it's making me think, what on earth did I do? There was more sun there in the winter than there is here.
Well, I don't know.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. There are no further questions in queue.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening in today.
Thank you very much. These were great questions, and thank you again for all the support and helping us work with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes your call.